Hello, World Cup road trippers. It's the day. The World Cup is underway. Day one, Ecuador have just pantsed Qatar. Feeling of satisfaction, I guess, from me. Haven't loved Qatar getting the World Cup. It's Tony Wilson here, one half of the 2018 World Cup road trip. Francis Leach, I think he is road tripping himself, but he's not at the World Cup in Qatar. He promised me during the last episode that he would not be going. I was not so sure. In fact, in a fit of green and gold ecstasy, I did buy match tickets with my long-time World Cup collaborator, Cameron Fink. We invested. We decided to go. But then we did start to have doubts, not just because of what's gone on in Qatar, in the building of the stadiums and the ill treatment of migrant workers and the dirty way in which they were awarded the World Cup. How could our $42 million only buy one vote? FIFA, you stink. But I was also wary of things like heat, how hot it was going to be during the day, the fact that it was all in one city and we wouldn't be road tripping around a country in the way that other World Cups have allowed. And so Cam and I put our tickets up for resale. We're not going. And it's a bit of a shame. I feel a heaviness. But I certainly wish everyone well who listened to the show last time and who are out there in Qatar, and hopefully it's a stellar performance, an unexpectedly pleasing performance from the Socceroos. So there is no 2022 Qatar World Cup road trip podcast, but I did want to point out that I do have another podcast. I have a podcast that's been going for the last 2 years called Speakola, and it's a great speeches podcast. Basically, I feature a great, famous, sometimes not famous speech. Just a speech where there's a story attached, where there's a moment in history where the speaker or the historian or the person in the audience can cast a bit of light on some words. And we play the speech and we talk about the speech. And it's gone pretty well. 100,000 downloads so far. So if you're interested, check out Speakola. Some of my better guests include Academy Award winner Adam Elliott, who gave a speech in front of, I think it was 1.5 billion people that night when he won the Oscar in 2005. I had the leader of the UK Labour Party on, a guy by the name of Neil Kinnock, who spoke about the I Warn You speech that he delivered on the eve of the 1983 UK election. I've spoken to the unmasked protester in Hong Kong, a guy who stood up in the legislature, put his life at risk for his ideals. I've spoken to the head of the Martin Luther King Center, Dr. Claiborne Carson, who was there on that day when I Have a Dream was delivered, and he's dedicated his life to the study of Martin Luther King. I've done one on JFK's inaugural speech with his biographer, Dr. Frederick Logerval, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his last book. I've done comedian Nellie Thomas talking about her eulogy for Stella Young. I've done playwright Margaret Edson talking about her commencement speech at Smith University. The stories are from around the world. The guests are from around the world. And so check it out. Look up Speakola with your podcast provider. And join us over there. It's going really well and it's a lot of fun to do. There's also a newsletter associated, news.speakola.com. And in my writing life, in my other general creative life, I have another newsletter called goodonewilson.substack.com. Look up Good One Wilson and you can find me there as well. So that's me and what I'm doing. And to get a taste of the Speakola podcast, here's my episode with Simon Hill. I had him on talking about commentary. Is commentary a speech? I don't know. But I do know that Simon Hill is a brilliant guest. He's over there with the Green and Gold Army this month. But he was wonderful on Speakola, and here's his episode.
Wales long throw. Goalkeeper's come. Hasn't got there. Harry Kewell. And then poked home by Tim Cahill. Australia have done it. 6 minutes to go, and it's a landmark moment for Australian football. Tim Cahill has scored the nation's first ever World Cup finals goal. He did it against the Dutch. especially as they have the impetus. Aloisi, Cahill, Cahill! Tim Cahill has done it again! What a goal by Tim Cahill! 2-1 Australia! Oh, it's a wonderful moment in Kaiserslautern! And Tim Cahill has come off the bench and maybe won the match for the Socceroos. Aloisi. Hadouka's in an offside position. Aloisi might go on his own. Aloisi! 3-1! It's all over! 3 points for Australia! What about that? Japan have collapsed in the closing moments. And John Aloisi, who wrote one chapter in Australian football history back in November 2005, adds a little postscript for the Socceroos.
That is the sound of pure joy, at least to Australian ears. I apologise to our Japanese listeners, which the latest Speakola metrics tell me there are two. Apologies to both of you. You're probably expat Australians anyway, but Simon Hill there calling the famous last 8 minutes from Kaiserslautern in Germany at the 2006 World Cup, when the Australian Socceroos first tasted World Cup glory. Simon Hill is my guest today, and he's going to be talking about the art and the craft of commentary. Is sporting commentary a speech? Maybe I'm stretching the premise of the podcast a bit, but it is kind of talking, and the motto of the website is all speeches great and small. Surely it fits into speech great or small. And anyway, who cares? It's my podcast. I can do what I want. And here he comes.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields.
If you lay down with dogs, you get fleas.
Fraud, sham, and hypocrisy. Change within the system.
Hollow man of anger and bitterness, all must be left to a bygone age.
I understand victory! I understand sacrifice!
Speakola.
I may not get there with you, but we as a people will get to the promised land!
Speakola.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General.
Speakola. With Tony Wilson.
Hello and welcome. And as you probably got there from the introductory remarks, I am pretty excited about this episode. I am a big football fan, a Socceroos fan, also a Melbourne Victory fan, and also a Simon Hill fan. I regard him as pretty much the best commentator going around any sport in Australia. This episode stands as the podcast equivalent of the 25-metre curling right footer past the outstretched arm into the top right corner. Simon Hill is such a good storyteller. He has a beautiful voice, and he had an acoustically beautiful commentator's headset he could put on. So it really does sound like we're speaking in the same room together, despite Simon being up there in Sydney and me being here in Melbourne. For overseas listeners, he has commentated with the BBC and ITV, but he eventually made his name here at SBS in Australia, and then on to Fox Sports, where his name is synonymous with the sport in this country. So here he is, Simon Hill.
Speakola.
Well, we've had 20 guests on the podcast, and they've come in all shapes and sizes. But of all the guests so far, only one of them has ever made my ringtone, and that is our guest today. Thanks for joining us, Simon Hill.
I'm very honoured that I was your ringtone. Am I still your ringtone, or is that long gone?
I think it was an intervention from the family that just didn't want to hear Tim Cahill has done it again. What a goal from Tim Cahill every time someone called up. So it was binned eventually, but there was a glorious couple of years really when you were pinging into my life regularly.
Well, my apologies to your family for distracting them for all those years. Wasn't my intention.
Well,
to get us to that point, which is such a meaningful moment, I guess, for me and millions of Australians who love sport, I thought I'd talk a bit about the art and the craft of commentary. And in my view, you're as good as we've got in this country. Tell us a little bit about how you came to it. What sort of a kid were you, Simon?
Like most kids growing up in Northern England, where I grew up, I was football mad, and it's never really left me, to be honest. I was introduced to the game by my dad, who was and still is at 86, a mad Manchester City fan. My granddad was the same. My great-grandfather, I've told this story a few times, actually played for them in the 1890s. So this is a long family heritage of love for football, and in particular for Manchester City. So when I was 4 or 5 years old, you know, my dad brought out a football and we'd kick the ball around. So I loved playing. And then when I was 6, he took me to my first Manchester City game, and I just fell in love with my club, basically, particularly those beautiful sky blue jerseys and Colin Bell in particular. And from that moment on, I wanted to be in football, you know, however I could. Obviously, I wanted to play the game professionally, but I knew pretty early, in fact, age 12, that I wasn't going to be good enough, because a Manchester City scout actually came to watch the team that I played for when I was a junior. And I ran around like a madman for, you know, 90 minutes, desperately trying to catch his eye. Nah, nothing. Crickets. So from that point on, I think even then I knew that I wasn't going to be good enough to play. So my next question was, okay, if I'm not going to be a professional footballer, how am I going to work in football? And obviously the journalistic thing was, you know, the next best thing. So even in those early days as a kid, I had that in mind. I had no idea I was going to get there, obviously. But yeah, I think it was the seed had been planted even at that stage of my life.
And when you thought journalist, was it print journalist? Did you immediately think, oh, one day I'll become a writer and I'll get in the newspaper and I'll follow them around that way? Or were you already, did you have your ears open to the sounds of the sport, the great commentators of the era?
Well, I did have my ears open to, you know, some of those great commentators. In fact, my commentary idol, although I probably wouldn't have called him that at the time, but I loved listening to him, was a guy called Brian Butler, who, along with Peter Jones, worked on the old BBC Radio 2 covering football. And in the days before the modern ISDN hookups, they would travel all over Europe, all over the world, covering football basically on what was a phone, the old reporter phone, as I later found out when I started doing commentary. So these crackly lines, you know, from Eastern Europe, normally covering Liverpool in some place like Bucharest or Budapest. And I just found it intoxicating. I loved all that. But I have to say, my ambition was always to write. I just wanted to write about football. And I, being a lefty, of course, I envisaged that I would be on The Guardian or The Daily Mirror in the UK. Never really gave broadcasting a moment's thought. And it wasn't until I went to university, I did a postgrad course, the NCTJ pre-entry course in newspaper journalism, which is a very long title. Did a little bit of print work, working for the news newspaper in Portsmouth. And then when I came out in 1991, there was a big recession on in the UK. So there weren't a lot of jobs in journalism, weren't a lot of jobs anywhere, to be honest. And I applied for so many and got nowhere. And I spotted this job for a radio station in South Wales called Red Dragon FM, writing adverts, commercial copywriting, basically. So I thought, well, in the current climate, I'm probably not going to get a journalistic job. So at least this is writing. So I applied for it. And got a letter back saying, look, I don't think you're suitable really for this job, but we've got a job here as a sports reporter if you'd be interested in applying. So that's where my career path sort of changed almost before it began. And of course, that's what I wanted to do. I knew nothing about radio or broadcasting, but Red Dragon was a good place to learn. And that's what I did. And I've sort of been on that path ever since.
So Red Dragon in South Wales. Do you remember the first time you picked up the microphone and had to string some words together?
Yeah, I do. I remembered, I think the first few months, I only just presented the sports bulletin. So I had to write them as well and present them. And look, you know, I was a reasonably confident speaker in public. I've never been shy to open my mouth. So, you know, I wasn't nervous about it. But obviously, there is an art to it, even just presenting, you know, a few lines of sports news. So, yeah, it took a while before I became, you know, fully comfortable on air. And then within a few months, of course, I was champing at the bit and I wanted to present the sports show and wanted to go out and cover games, all the stuff that I loved. So it flowed on sort of quite naturally and quite quickly. And my progression was, you know, quite sharp. And within 18 months, I'd left Red Dragon and I'd moved up into BBC local radio. So that's when my education really began, I suppose.
And when do you start covering big time professional football? When do you start calling games? It was back in the UK, wasn't it?
Yes. This is always an interesting one because, you know, most commentators will tell you that they start off at the lowest rung of the level covering, you know, non-league football or the local Sunday league or something. My first ever commentary was Chelsea against Blackburn Rovers in the Premier League. I didn't, you know, there's no half measures with me. I'd sort of covered games in the lower leagues as a reporter for Red Dragon, but I hadn't actually done a full commentary. I'd done sort of snippets of commentary. And when I went to Radio Lancashire, which was my first BBC local radio station, I was there with a guy called Guy Havord, who was my senior producer, and we sort of divided the work up between us. And when the new season came into view, which was 1993, he said to me, "Okay, opening weekend of the season, I want you to go down to London, and I want you to do second half commentary on Chelsea Blackburn." And I said, "Okay, you know, I've never done full commentary before." And he said, "Well, let's see if you can do it." So that was it, basically. Down I went to Stamford Bridge, and I've barely stopped since.
Well, how would you have prepared that day? You would have been crapping yourself, wouldn't you? So I presume you just, yeah, you would have done about 25 hours of staring at names and numbers, yeah, would you? Was that the first day?
Absolutely. And of course, you know, you've got to remember that in 1993, the internet didn't exist. And there were no such things as Facebook or Twitter or, you know, websites. Or if they were in their absolute infancy. So the way that you prepared for games in those days was very different to today. You know, I searched reference books. I used to have piles of the old Rothmans football yearbook with all the previous season stats. Obviously, there was no YouTube, so you couldn't, you know, look at clips of the previous games or anything like that. And I remember faxing. Remember faxing? Yeah. I remember actually not faxing. I phoned up Chelsea and asked them to fax me pen pictures of their players, which they did. That's how we did it in those days. You know, it's almost, I don't know, it feels like the Middle Ages, doesn't it, in comparison? But things move so quickly. You know, in those days in the office, you still had the old landline telephones and the manual typewriter to type out your bulletins. And the latest news came, you know, not online or via wire services. Well, there were wire services, but they came out of what they called a teleprinter, which was stationed in the corner of the newsroom, and you could hear it chugging away, you know, 24 hours a day. So it was a different world, totally different world.
But it is the same art. It's an art that's gone through, I guess, the whole broadcast era. We've had, since we've had recorded sound, we've had elements of recorded sport. What is the art form? I mean, you could argue I'm sort of self-indulgently stretching what has been a podcast about speeches to include, you know, one of my real passions, which is sport and then sport commentary and then the way that commentary then, I think, crystallizes into a moment. What do you think the art is of commentary?
It's a good question, and I think it's something that has many answers. The art initially is to do your research. That is so important, particularly today when your audience has access to just as much information, if not more, as you do. So you've got to be bang on the money. In terms of, you know, how you put together a commentary, well, every commentary is different because you are literally watching something unfold in 1,000 different ways that you're not prepared for, at least in terms of, you know, you can't script it. So you've got to be ready. It's as simple as that. You've got to be ready for every eventuality.
So, Simon, that reminds me of the great Woody Allen line. I think it's a Woody Allen observation, which is that sport is the only art form where even the writers don't know how it's going to end.
It's true. It's so true. You know, the only thing that you do know in a football game is that it's either going to be a win or a loss for either team or a draw. Those are the only outcomes that you know. Everything else is in the lap of the gods. And to be honest, that's what makes it exciting and so invigorating to be involved in. Now, obviously, if you can talk underwater, as you know, hopefully I can, that helps. And you've got to be very dexterous linguistically with your words, because things move at a fast old pace. You know, a game of football in particular, it can really crack along at a fair old rate of knots. So you've got to keep up with it. You've got to know the right terminology. You've got to know the rules to a large degree. You can opinionate a little bit, but you don't want to opinionate too much, certainly not as a play-by-play caller. That's what your summarizer is there for. And also in television, you've got things like replay monitors, and you've got stats, and you've got producers and directors in your ear. So it's not quite as straightforward as everybody thinks. And I've always likened it to this. It's like trying to drive a car with a wobbly wheel, and it keeps wanting to veer off either to the left or to the right. And your job is to keep correcting it and keeping it on the middle of the road, because it can veer off in a million different directions. And if you're not careful, it can run away with you. So you've got to keep trying to bring it back to the center, keep repeating, you know, what this means, the context of what you're seeing. People might be tuning in, you know, they might have missed the first 15 minutes. So you might have to remind them of the score on a regular basis. If you're working in radio in particular, if you're on TV, of course, you can see it in the top left-hand corner. But you've got to be aware of, you know, a million different things. And it's a tricky art form. And, you know, I've done it for 30 years and I still think I've got an awful lot to learn about it. You know, some of the other things, don't talk too much, but don't talk too little. In television, you've got to talk around the pictures rather than describe what they are, because people can see them. In radio, it's the other way around, where, you know, silence is death. Whereas silence in television can be golden. And Richie Beno was, you know, the great exponent of that. Saying nothing can be just as important as saying something. So that there's lots of different elements that go up into making a commentator and a good commentary. And at the end of the day, and this is, you know, probably the most esoteric thing about it, is you can come away thinking, yeah, I did well today. And half the people might give you abuse because they think you didn't. So it's all subjective, you know, and commentators divide opinion in the same way that players and particularly referees do. You know, half the people might love you, half of them might hate you. A lot of people think you're biased. That's the word we get most. You're biased. Let me tell you, you ain't got time to be biased. You're too focused. Even when it's your own team, you're too focused on what you're doing.
I agree with pretty much everything you said then. But and one thing, about, especially the passion it evokes, the commentator's voice is in your ear so much that people truly loathe commentators. I think if you can come out as a commentator who is generally liked, given how present you are in the life and given the number of opportunities there are to be loathed, you're doing really well. So, I mean, I think you're generally a popular commentator, but I presume you get some abuse out there, Simon?
Oh, yeah. Blimey. Yes, of course. Every commentator gets abuse. And that's, to be honest, one of the reasons why I stayed off social media for so many years, because I just didn't want that extra pressure. You know, I put myself under enough pressure. I don't need, you know, to read 100 comments abusing me to know that. I can get that at home. But, you know, probably the biggest compliment you get is after you've done a game, and you will get four pieces of abuse, and two of them are saying you're biased to one team and two of them are saying you're biased to another. And I've had that a few times. And when I read that, I always think, yep, I've done all right.
Take us back to the 90s again. Was there either a moment where you felt like, oh, this is crashingly difficult and I've made a big mess of it? Or was there one where you thought, I'm on my way up, I'm doing well at this, this is my life?
Yeah, a couple of examples. The first one of thinking, blimey, this is difficult and I've stuffed it up. I did a very low-key game in the lower leagues of England. I think it was Mansfield against Preston, a game in the third division at Field Mill. And this was a radio commentary. And I went along and I was happily doing full commentary on my own, which we always did in those days. And I'd taken my dad along because my dad loves football. And he's always, you know, where are you going this week? Can I come? And most of the time I'd say, look, you can't, Dad, because it's a press box. But on this particular occasion, there was a couple of seats spare. So I said, look, come along, sit next to me, but stay quiet. You know, say nothing. So anyway, I'm happily doing commentary, and Preston scored through a guy called Tony Ellis, who I always remember. And as I was describing the goal, out of the corner of my eye, I saw in the director's box beneath me a bit of a commotion going on. Some guy had keeled over and was obviously unwell and was having, you know, people around him trying to take his jacket off, and then the paramedics arrived. The guy had obviously had a heart attack, okay? And I was sort of half aware of this and still trying to call the game. And because I was young, inexperienced, the excitement of the moment, commentary does strange things to your brain. You can get disconnected from reality. And my dad, who was trying to help me, to be honest, was trying to get some information. And he found out that this guy was a Preston director and that he'd had a heart attack. So he wrote it on a slip of paper and put it underneath my nose. Now, me being young, I just looked at it and repeated it verbatim. And as soon as I'd said it, I thought, imagine if that guy's family's listening to this back home. I didn't name him because I didn't know who he was. But clearly, you know, there's only half a dozen Preston directors. So for the rest of the game, I was thinking, I have made such a big mistake. And it was a big mistake. And to be honest, I thought I might lose my job over that. I was only 25, 26. But thankfully, the guy who was the boss at Radio Lancashire, a guy called Steve Taylor, I had a chat with him on the Monday. He's like, look, you know, I understand how that mistake happened, but obviously that's something that you can't do again. So that was a big sort of wake-up call for me. You know, you've got to keep your brain engaged in all things, not even just football sometimes when you're at a football game. The other example of thinking, well, not that I've made it, but wow, isn't this great? I'm doing okay. Is the first Premier League game, obviously, was Chelsea Blackburn, but also 95, 96, I was working for the BBC World Service and I called the FA Cup final. Now, for a kid growing up in England, you know, that's something really special. At Wembley, the old Wembley, two teams I didn't particularly like, Man United and Liverpool, but yeah, that was very, very special. And again, I think seeing, you know, how proud my dad was when I told him that I was calling the Cup final, he's like, wow, that's pretty good, son.
Yeah.
And it was.
Yeah. And then Australia, you become synonymous with football in Australia and football calling, but how do you come to us? What's the story of coming here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've answered this one a few times as well. So after I left the BBC in 2001, I went to ITV. They were just setting up a new TV channel called the ITV Sport Channel, strangely enough. And I thought I was going to be there for 15, 20 years. You know, they had a great plan to cover football. And unfortunately, within 12 months, it all went wrong. And they didn't have a good business plan. The network went into administration and we were all made redundant. So in 2002, I sort of freelanced for 6 months, but I was looking around for that next opportunity. And during one of my sort of down periods, I went over to Korea to watch the World Cup in 2002. And on the back end of that, I came to Australia for 5 days to see an old mate of mine that I'd worked with at the BBC called Rob Minshall, big city fan like me, a Manc. He'd been out here a few years. And he said to me, you know, SBS are looking for a commentator. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. He's like, you should go for it. You know, you'd be great. I was like, nah, they're not going to want me. You know, I'm there over the other side of the earth. I don't know who I am. No, you should go for it. And to be honest, he went on about it for so long that more to shut him up than anything else. When I got back to the UK, I said, look, I'll send in a CV and a showreel, thinking that would be it. And I did. And yeah, to my amazement, Ken Shipp from SBS got in contact a couple of weeks later and said, look, we're really interested. Do you want to come to Australia? Now, the strange thing was, is I actually, at the same time, had an offer to sign for Sky Sports in the UK. And at the time, you know, and they still are, the big player in the UK. And I had a big decision to make. And a lot of people thought I'd made the wrong one by not signing for Sky. You know, why do you want to go to Australia? Where are you going? Australia? To work for who? SBS. What are they? And it's, you know, it's a fair question. I didn't know the answers, to be honest. But I'd had, you know, such a bad experience at ITV because I'd thought that was my future and, you know, it had turned out not to be the case. I think I was just at the point in my life where I was ready to try something a little bit different. I'd always wanted to live overseas and experience, you know, a different lifestyle, etc. So when this appeared, I thought, if you don't do it now, and I was 35 then, if you don't do it now, you'll never do it. So I decided to give it a go, and here I still am 18 years later. You can't get rid of me now.
I'm going to take you back to very happy times. We like to have feature speeches here on the Speakola podcast, and for that we drag out a specific little item of audio, and the one I'm going to go with, as you can no doubt guess, is this one.
Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
For us.
He scored! Australia have got it!
John! Come on!
John Aloisi, the Confederations Cup hero, has done it in the biggest game of all.
Come on, Australia! Johnny Wayne!
At last! At long, long last!
Simon, it doesn't get any more special for me than that. The 16th of November 2005, a date etched in the brain of many Socceroos fans. And in my case, I watched the Socceroos lose in 1997 at the MCG and made a vow in the stands that day. It was falling in love with the code, really, because I'd never felt that way at a sporting event. And I vowed that having missed out in such a tragic way, I would see the Socceroos qualify wherever it happened in the world. And I went on vigils to Uruguay, and it's ultimately turned me into a travelling Socceroos fan, which has been wonderful. But take us to this red letter day, the 16th of November 2005. How long had you been in the job? What were your expectations? Talk us through it.
Well, I'd been in the job at SBS for nearly 2 years then, and some people might remember in Australia, I'd just come off the back of hosting the Ashes cricket series, which was huge for me and the country and for SBS, to be honest, because it was such a brilliant series, the closest they'd been in many, many years. So I had a huge 2005, and then right on the back end of it, of course, was these two qualifiers against Uruguay. Now, I'd been in Montevideo 4 days prior for the first leg. So by the time I got back to Sydney, I was pretty jet-lagged, pretty tired, and I knew how important this game was for the country and for the sports in Australia. We just set up the A-League, and the boost of, you know, Australia qualifying for its first World Cup finals in 32 years would have been massive. So we knew how important this was. I've said this on many occasions. That night is not my favourite in professional terms. I know a lot of people remember it differently because the results, and there's actually, you know, a good lesson in this for all commentators. It ain't about us. It's about what happens on the pitch. And people always remember that with such joy and positivity, even around the call. Let me tell you, professionally, the call was horrible. It was awful. You know, mine wasn't great, and I had Craig Foster yelling in my ear because he was overly emotionally involved in it. If you break it down, you know, in a purely professional sense, it was pretty damned ordinary. However, none of that matters because the Socceroos won, and that's what it was about. And in retrospect, you know, I'm really grateful to have been involved in that night and happy that people remember it in such a great way, because I remember coming away from the stadium that night, and look, I was delighted Australia qualified, as everybody was, but I wasn't happy with, you know, my performance that night, nor of, you know, mine and Craig's performance together, because we knew it was pretty ordinary. But that's, you know, that's the way things go. You only get one shot at it, and as luck would have it, because the Socceroos won, it's been remembered in a very nice and positive way. And for that, I'm very grateful and very damned fortunate, let me tell you.
Here is Kuehl. His first touch, Chipperfield. Finding Cahill. Look how tight the space is. Here's Harry Kuehl.
It's still in!
Australia have scored! Marco Bresciano! 33 minutes played, and Telstra Stadium erupts. Australia are level. What a moment.
So the first goal that went in from Bresciano, wasn't it? That was called in a competent way. And I mean, Fozzie was it would have been hard to work with him because he's got 15 years of baggage at this point, hasn't he? He is in no state to be able to be an objective expert comments man. And really, there have been plenty of examples of great sporting events where the tide turns towards partisanship from the commentators. I mean, the greatest call of the Maradona goal, the second great goal in the 86 World Cup against England, is the Argentinian call where they start yelling genio, you know, genius, genius at the end of it.
Genio, Jairo Tonto inglés, para que el país se opuse apretado, gritando por Argentina. Argentina 2, Inglaterra 0. Diego, Diego, Diego Armando Maradona. Gracias Dios por el fútbol, por Maradona, por esas lágrimas, por este Argentina 2, Inglaterra 0.
There is a place for hyper-partisanship, isn't there?
Possibly. I think that the difficulty for me was, having come through the BBC school, and this is going to sound terribly highbrow and old-fashioned, but it's true. You were told that editorial, you know, non-partisanship was your job as a commentator. No matter who you were calling for, you were always supposed to be neutral. And I still had that very much in my head. Now, to be fair, you know, as the years have gone on, I've probably relaxed that a little bit. But in those days in particular, I was determined that I was going to be, you know, right down the middle and to try and be as fair as I possibly can be. And obviously, it didn't particularly work out that way because in large part, Fozzie was, you know, so emotionally invested. Now, look, I understood why he was, you know, emotionally invested in it. But I think, had Australia lost, and of course, you know, it could have gone either way in penalties. I think that call would perhaps have been received very differently, but I don't know. And I'm pleased that we'll never know, because it's very nice to be associated with, you know, with that particular moment, and for it to be remembered so fondly. You know, it's, as a commentator, you're lucky if you get, you know, one of those moments per career. I've had a few. So I'm very fortunate, really.
Well, before I get to another one of my favourites, the one that made the ringtone, can you take us back to really post the Schwarzer save, the second save, the one where Fozzie shrieks, you know, yeah, that's as big as we've seen.
It's a huge save, yeah, a huge save.
That's the biggest we've seen in Australia.
A great one to save.
Schwarzer just perhaps a little mind game with Salajet, asking whether the ball was on the spot. Here is Salajet.
Huge save.
Wonderful save.
It's as big as we've ever seen in Australia. I'm sorry, it is. It's as big as we've ever seen under pressure. It's the sort of heart that you need to make World Cups. Mark Schwarzer, you are a champion.
What happens next in that commentary box?
Well, what happened next was, obviously, Fozzie was gone. You know, emotionally, he was all over the place. So I was on my own, basically. And amid all the tumult, I saw out the corner of my eye Johnny Aloisi striding very purposefully with his head down, studying concentration, walking up to take the next penalty. And look, call it tiredness, emotion, or whatever it was, jet lag from Montevideo. I remember thinking, my God, if he scores this, is that it? And I had that moment where you have the complete mental blank. So you can hear this in the call a little bit as I say, so that means that if Australia can score this goal, they will be there. And whilst I was doing that, I had grabbed Nick Christou, who is one of the producers at SBS, literally by the lapels and asked him to confirm, in, you know, eye to eye, that what I was saying was actually correct. And Nick had a moment of blind panic as well, because I'd thrust this responsibility on him out of nowhere. And he did a quick bit of, you know, mathematical gymnastics in his head and just about got the thumbs up that what I'd said was correct as Johnny took a step back. And, you know, my next line was, here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
Now, that means that if John Aloisi can score this goal, Australia will be there.
Are you sure?
I'm trying to do my maths. 4-2. I can hardly.
4-2. He wins it for us. John.
Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
He wins it for us.
He scored! Australia have got it!
John! Come on!
John Aloisi, the Confederations Cup hero, has done it. Have passed since Australia ended its campaign at the 74 World Cup. And now, finally, belatedly, wonderfully and joyfully, Australia is back on the biggest stage. What a night! What drama, what tension.
And thankfully, I got it out.
And do you have when we get away from the art towards the craft, is there a certain thing that works or that you will favour for a key moment like that? The last penalty in a penalty shootout, is something very crisply true the way to go, or does it change each time? Do you know what you're doing there?
Yeah, it all depends upon context. All depends upon context. Now, you know, had Mark Schwartz not made that brilliant save prior to Johnny taking that next penalty, if Australia had been, you know, 2-0 up and it was the third kick, it would have still been a massive moment, but it wasn't quite the knife edge that we had that night against Uruguay, where it still could have gone either way had Johnny missed his penalty. So you see, it's about context. I always use this example as well, that, you know, when Alessandro Del Piero made his home debut for Sydney, I don't know if you remember that game against the Newcastle Jets, with 35,000 people there. They'd all turned up to see Del Piero, and they wanted to see him score. Now, I had a little line in my head that was ready for Del Piero if he scored a goal, but to use it, it still had to be the right context. Had he scored his first goal from 2 inches out and it had a bit rebounded off his backside over the line, the line, you know, me eulogising Del Piero's talent wouldn't have worked because it was a tap-in. But the fact that he scored a free kick from 25 metres and bent it past the wall and through the keeper was perfect, you know. So I could use that.
Del Piero! That's what they came to see! That's why Sydney FC paid the money! That is the measure of the man!
You know, you still got to, even if you prepare the odd little line here and there, you still got to know that it's the right context to use it. Now, to be fair, for that penalty for, you know, Australia, for Johnny Aloisi, the line, here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup, which I've heard a million times since, that certainly wasn't scripted, because how could I have known?
Yeah.
I couldn't have known that it was going to be for a place in the World Cup, or indeed that it was going to be John Aloisi that might have sent us there. So, you know, most of the time you are reacting literally in the moment, and the lines either come out perfectly or they don't. And, you know, the better commentators deliver better lines than not. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, Simon, I am actually physically bursting with joy again thinking about it. And this is the effect that sport has on some of us. And the night explodes into fireworks as John Aloisi runs with his shirt whirling above his head and them all trying to get to him. And meanwhile, you're still trying to talk, but Fozzie is throwing just exclamations into the ether.
Yep.
He's got he yells out, "Johnny, go on, my son!" I think at one point,
Ray Bartz, Johnny Warren.
Did he say Ray Bartz?
Yeah, there was. I think Ray Bartz made an appearance at some stage.
But, and Johnny Warren. He said that he wanted to say Johnny Warren told us so, but he didn't get the whole way through it.
Yeah.
But Johnny Warren, I actually love that he just says the names and the whole effect. I mean, it is you know, horribly unprofessional, but it is. It's part of the folklore now. But then you say a line, and I did wonder whether this was scripted, because I think if it's out of control and popping with the fireworks for a moment, it does get dragged back to earth with the reality of the achievement. And that's when you refer to how long Australia had been out of the World Cup. I think you said it was it 32 years?
31 years, yeah.
That bit.
8 months, how many days?
Was that...
Yeah, look, I mean, I had that written down, obviously, because otherwise you're not going to remember those specific numbers off the top of your head. I had, you know, a couple of key things scribbled down because, of course, you know, when you're calling a moment of that significance that hasn't happened in over three decades, you know, you want to get it right and you don't just want to repeat over and over, we've done it, we're there, yes. You know, you want to have, I think, something that means something and that resonates down the years. So, you know, when you call in big moments like that, sometimes it's helpful to have a couple of pointers. So, yeah, I had those dates written down. I'm not ashamed to admit that. And again, you know, it's about inserting them into the right moments, which, let me tell you, with Fozzie there yelping was pretty damn difficult. So I got a few of the lines out that I wanted to. And again, I think, you know, it was about putting it all into context about what that victory meant, the historical significance, the emotion of it all. And also just in, you know, in terms of the night, I remember thinking, making reference to Huss Hiddink being a legend and a genius.
And he was. And it's ended in success. And Huss Hiddink is a legend.
Oh, he's a freak. He's a genius. And his legend grows.
Huss Hiddink has succeeded. Before him, Frank Arup, Terry Venables, Eddie Thompson, Frank Farina, all tried so hard. But tonight is Australia's night. They've deserved it. They've earned it. They said it was their time. It is their time. I tell you what, Greg, may not have been born in Australia. Tonight, I am, you are, we are Australia.
People forget this because the mists of time shroud everything. That 6 months prior to that, they'd gone to the Confederations Cup and they'd lost all three games. Frank Farina was sacked. You know, the national team was in complete disarray, really. And Huss came along and within 2 or 3 months had gelled it into this super competitive unit that had you know, gone to the World Cup. It was an amazing story. Still is today. To beat a team of the quality of Uruguay, this is the other thing we forget. You know, they had Ricardo Morales, they had Lugano, they had Alvaro Recoba. They were a bloody good side. Yeah. And they could have so easily won that night. So, you know, to get over the line and make it to the finals. And I was also, you know, I wanted to put it into context in terms of the game itself. Because, and you know this, Tony, you know, our game in this country, it gets a lot of abuse. It gets a lot of stick. It's, you know, it's not the favored sport in this country. And that was almost like a lifting of a great weight off the shoulders of a lot of football supporters in this country. I'd only been in Australia for 2 years. I felt it. Mm. I knew how much that meant to football people, let alone the country. I knew the country would celebrate because it always does when it's Australia winning something. But for football fans, this was really, really important, really special, particularly with the A-League having just kicked off. And then I knew we had a whole 6-7 months build up towards the World Cup in Germany to come as well. It was terrific.
And was that your first World Cup, or did you say that you were in Japan, Korea as well?
I was in Japan, Korea as a fan. I'd also gone to the World Cup in France in 98 for the BBC. So it wasn't my first World Cup. It was actually my third, but it was my first actually calling games. So that was very special as well.
Yeah. And we all marched into it, and I climbed that hill in Kaiserslautern, as you did, Simon.
The Betzenberg.
And went through the gates right next to George Negus, with Negus written on his back. And we go in, and we don't know what to expect. And there's been, I guess, as you said, the Confederations Cup, we were outclassed, and we were playing the regional rival in Japan, or the one that's become the regional rival. Can you tell us the way that game unfolded until we get to the bit where, you know, where you become my ringtone?
I remember being more nervous for that game than the Uruguay game, actually, because all of a sudden this was the World Cup. It wasn't just about getting there anymore. This was about the World Cup. And it was a blisteringly hot day, as I'm sure you remember. I walked the Betzenberg Hill as well, was sweating by the time I got to the top of it. Took my place in the commentary position, had done all my research. I remember phoning home and speaking to my wife and saying, you know, what's it like over there? And there was a lot of noise behind her. And she was out at a fan fest in Sydney. I said, it sounds a bit noisy there. She said, yeah, there's about 10,000 people here. I was like, wow. Okay. And that's like 2 o'clock in the morning in Australia. So that sort of struck home to me just how big this game was, even back home in the middle of the night. So I remember being quite nervous until the game kicked off. And then, you know, when a game of football kicks off, it's a bit weird. You sort of get into a groove. It's either a World Cup in Kaiserslautern or a wet, you know, Wednesday in Wigan. It's still a game of football. So you get into a sort of a rhythm. I also remember that obviously Japan took the lead through a goal from Shunsuke Nakamura that's probably had a hint of a foul in it. Mm. And at halftime, I remember sitting down for a little bit of a break and Santo Chilaro came up towards me. I thought, oh, there's Santo. I said, hi, Santo. And he launched into this rant about the referee. It's like, you know, even you know, world-class comedians, famous comedians are so caught up in all this, and all he wanted to do was talk about the referee. So, yeah, that's how it went until those crazy last 10 minutes.
Just before we get to them, I know there's a famous story for Australian fans of Santo Chilaro, who is a comedian with the group Working Dog, that that Mark Viduka bailed him up in the rooms after that win. And all Santo
wanted videos.
All Santo wanted to talk about was the win. And said, Mark, you've done us so proud. You've changed the sport in this country. It's incredible. That's what Santo was saying. And look, we're going crazy in there, Santo. You got any late show videos or something? Yeah. he wanted comedy videos for the camp. Brilliant.
That's Dukes.
Yeah.
That's Dukes.
So you take us to the last 10 minutes. I was getting very scared. It was a very high level of anxiety that had built up, I think, amongst the fan base. And presumably, even as a new arrival in Australia, you had nerves in the pit of your stomach at that point.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wasn't that new by then. And I think that, you know, the Uruguay game had been quite a seminal moment for me as well. I'd been sort of quite not detached from the national team because I've called them a few times, but I don't know whether I'd sort of identified them as being my team up until the Uruguay game. And after that, everything changed. And then I was, you know, emotionally connected to them as well. I wanted them to win. It wasn't just my job. I wanted them to win. So those last 10 minutes, I remember thinking, yeah, this is getting away from them. And then they brought on Timmy Cahill, and I remember delivering the line, which people thought was a sponsored line. I can assure you it wasn't. I just said, because Timmy, if you remember, he was the face of Sanitarium, the Weet-Bix commercials at the time. So I remember when he came on and Australia still 1-0 down, saying, I hope he's had his Weet-Bix this morning. I remember a few people getting angry about that afterwards, saying, oh, you know, you're sticking commercial sponsors into games. I said, no, you know, it's literally just something off the top of my head. Anyway, he added his Weet-Bix, suddenly, because he came on and scored two belting goals. Those are really big moments. And again, I knew that once they scored that first goal, that was the nation's first ever at a World Cup finals. Well, what an honor for a foreigner to come in and after 3 years, be able to call that on national TV in Australia. So it's a brilliant day.
Moore's long throw. Goalkeeper's come. Hasn't got there. Harry Kewell. And they're poked home by Tim Cahill. Australia have done it. 6 minutes to go. And it's a landmark moment for Australian football. Tim Cahill has scored the nation's first ever World Cup finals goal. He did it against the Dutch.
Especially as they have the impetus. Aloisi. Cahill. Cahill! Tim Cahill has done it again! What a goal by Tim Cahill! 2-1 Australia! Oh, it's a wonderful moment in Kaiserslautern! And Tim Cahill has come off the bench and maybe won the match for the Socceroos.
And when you hear that, Simon, that gets played so often. Both of the goals get played so often. But are you happy with the commentary on the two of them?
Yeah, happier than I was for the Uruguay game. Yeah, they're okay. And the Johnny Aloisi goal that came afterwards as well.
Aloisi. Viduka's in an offside position. Aloisi might go on his own. Aloisi! 3-1! It's all over! 3 points for Australia! What about that? Japan have collapsed in the closing moments. And John Aloisi, who wrote one chapter in Australian football history back in November 2005, adds a little postscript for the Socceroos.
Yeah, I'm always been much more satisfied with the way, you know, the World Cup calls went in general. Maybe it's because I was more at ease with it. Maybe it's, you know, just the way the games went. Maybe it's because I didn't have Fozzie yelling my head. I don't know. But yeah, that World Cup was terrific, and I really enjoyed the experience. And again, you know, very grateful to have had that opportunity, really.
And something like the Tim Cahill has done it again. What a goal from Tim Cahill. Obviously, it can't be scripted. Is it somehow riding a wave? Like, what even is it? Is it to do with crack of voice? Is it to do with tone? What are you aiming for in these things where you know a nation is losing its mind?
Well, I think what you're trying to achieve is reflecting the moment emotionally for the audience and what they're feeling. Now, when I listen back to those goals, you can tell that I'm not just doing it for effect. I'm excited. And I was. You know, I knew what those moments meant to people back home. I knew what they meant to me and to everybody, you know, wearing the green and gold down on the pitch. So in that moment, those goals are actually in some ways quite easy to call because you can literally just let your emotion run riot. And I did for those goals because it was that sort of an occasion. Now, not every goal is like that. Obviously, you know, some goals scored in friendlies, even if they're 35-yard howitzers and they're brilliant goals, they don't necessarily have the meaning. So, again, it's about context. Context is everything. What does it mean, both in terms of the outcome but also the emotion for people watching? It's an emotional game, this, and you've got to reflect that.
And are there moments in football history where you just marvel at the commentary, where you say that is where you're aiming? Can you think of any favourites?
Yeah. Look, there's, you know, my idol Brian Butler calling the brilliant Maradona second goal, not the handball goal, the second goal against England. The World Cup 1986, and he's got this wonderful West Country burr, Brian Butler, with the R's just roll a little bit at the end. And he's Diego Maradona picks the ball up on halfway, goes past Fenwick, goes past Butcher, and he goes past Shilton. And that is why Diego Maradona is one of the greatest players in the world. He twisted past the defender like a little eel.
Maradona turns like a little eel and comes away from trouble. Little squat man comes inside Butcher, leaves him for dead. Outside Fenwick leaves him for dead and puts the ball away. And that is why Maradona is the greatest player in the world. He buries the English defence. He picked up that ball 40 yards out. First he left one man for dead. First he went past Saxon. It's a goal of great quality by a player of the greatest quality. It's England 0, Argentina 2. The first goal should never have been allowed. But Maradona has put the seal on his greatness. He's left his thumbprint on this World Cup. He scored a goal that England just couldn't cope with. They couldn't face up to. It was beyond their ability. It's England 0, Diego Maradona 2.
Just beautiful intonation and phrasing and, you know, building to that lovely crescendo at the end. He was absolutely terrific at it. Peter Jones, the same, his sidekick. There are other examples. The Tyler, you know, Sergio Aguero goal, obviously. Again, not just the Aguero, but the pause that follows. You know, to let the crowd take over.
Yeah.
Because they're explaining the context for him. He doesn't have to get
it. At Sunderland. Manchester United have done all they can. That Rooney goal was enough for the 3 points. Manchester City are still alive here. Balotelli, Aguero! I swear you'll never see anything like this ever again. So watch it, drink it in. To snatch the title away from Manchester United. Stupendous! The greatest moment I've seen in Premier League football. Unbelievable!
There are other commentators today that I, you know, my absolute favourites. I know people in Australia love Martin Tyler, and I do as well. But my absolute favourite at the moment is John Champion. He is by far, for me, the best English-speaking commentator in the world because he has such an economy of words that tells the story without having to go into all this, you know.
And the roadrunner is on his way. Alonso, last man back, releases it. Arshavin, four! Just astonishing.
And I one little example, the Manchester Derby was against my team as well, which wasn't great at the time, but Michael Owen playing for Manchester United scored, a 90th minute winner in a 4-3 classic. And the ball came over and he just went, Michael Owen wins it. And that was it. You know, sometimes you don't have to do the big flowery speech. He said it in a nutshell and the intonation was bang on.
And is there one that's yours? If you had to say, look, here's my CV and this is the one I love best. I've told you the ones I love best. Which ones do you love best?
Oh, there's a couple. I like the Terry Antonis one because I've been reminded of that, scoring for Melbourne Victory against Sydney in the finals.
Antonis had no right to get through there, really, but still he goes on. O'Neill giving chase forlornly. Still Terry Antonis! Has he won it for Melbourne Victory? The villain turned hero in navy blue runs to accept the adulation of the Victory fans. Are they heading to a sixth grand final? Extraordinary.
What a run.
Melbourne Victory upset the odds to book their spots in next weekend's grand final.
There are others going back many, many years. I remember calling an Alan Shearer goal when he was playing for Blackburn Rovers. That tells you how long ago it is. And I said, after a brilliant goal he scored at Elland Road against Leeds, you can't give him an inch because he takes a mile because he'd found space somehow impossibly. And, you know, there are little sort of one-liners you go, yeah, that was okay. I quite like that one. The Del Piero goal I like. The goals that Timmy scored at the World Cup, they'll, you know, live long in the memory. There's a few, to be honest. But, yeah, those are
some. We're unfortunately in a little Simon Hill hiatus. Post-COVID, it seemed that Fox Sports decided to go in different directions. Is there a story to tell there? Are you able to tell it?
Well, I mean, the story really is Fox Sports' to tell, not mine. You know, it wasn't my choice to go. I've said this before, it was both a shock but not a surprise. You're right that they've been going in a different direction for a long time. It had become quite clear to me that my face really didn't fit. And they decided that they no longer required me. So, you know, that's their choice, obviously. It's left me in a bit of a sticky situation in Australia, obviously, and in terms of my, you know, longer term career, because it was difficult to leave in the middle of a pandemic. Had things been normal, I probably would have returned to the UK. But given, you know, what's going on or has been going on over there, it probably wasn't the wisest thing to do. So I decided to tough it out for a year, which I've done. That year is coming to an end. We will find out where the next TV deal goes in the next few weeks. As I've said all along, if they're interested in my services, I'd be more than happy to talk to whoever takes it over. If they're not, then I understand. You know, maybe it's time for the next generation or something different. And I will, you know, say adieu to Australia because I need to keep working. And if that work is not here for me, then it has to be somewhere else. So, you know, that will probably mean a return to the UK or somewhere else, but certainly the UK initially, whilst I, you know, find out where it is I belong. So that's basically where I'm at. It's, you know, it's been a tough 12 months. I've missed doing football commentary. I'm very disappointed, you know, I'm not doing it, but certainly hoping that that's not the end of, you know, my career behind the microphone because I'm only 53. I hope I've still got a bit more to give. But we'll see. You know, this industry, as you know, Tony, is pretty brutal. Chews you up and spits you out at various points along the way. And the trick is, once you fall off the horse, is to try and get back on. So that's what I'm trying to do at the moment. Maybe the horse will kick a bit too hard this time. I don't know. But the honest answer is, you know, I don't know what the future holds. But whatever it is, it'll be involved in football in some shape or form.
And I guess you said that the rights deal will come up and that will help make your decision. Qatar actually is galloping up on us. Hopefully the tournament happens and we don't have, you know, the continuation of the COVID catastrophe, which puts things at risk. But if the World Cup happens as scheduled in 2022, is there a chance that you'd hang on? Let's say that the rights holder, local rights holder, didn't take you on. Is there a chance you'd put your hand up 2006 style to do a hit on the World Cup for us?
Well, no, because, you know, that tournament is still, where are we? May 21. That tournament is still 18 months away. So, you know, I can't hang on for a four-week tournament that's 18 months away without work. So the short answer to that is no, really. I need to be back in employment. I need to be earning. We've all got bills to pay. We all got to put food on the table. I'm no different. I'm certainly not rich enough to retire. So, I've got to get back in paid employment at some stage. And, hopefully that's here. And I've certainly not ruled that out. But if it's not, well, hey-ho. That's reality. And I'll make my next move accordingly.
And if we move just slightly off the art and the craft of commentating and the career of Simon Hill and look at the bigger picture of Australian football, which is something I'm pretty passionate about. And
this could be a long chat.
You're as involved as anyone, and we haven't got quite as long as the football-specific podcast, but can you tell us what should happen in the next little while? I just went to a game for Melbourne Victory. I think it was 3 weeks ago, where it felt like there were less than 2,000 people in the Amy Park, and it feels about as dark as things have felt since the Golden Generation and the joy of that night in November of 2005. What needs to happen? If you had to just rattle it off on your fingers there, Simon, are there some revolutionary moves we could make?
Well, not really. There's no silver bullets, but the old saying is it's always darkest before the dawn. Now, I'm hoping that dawn is going to come with the new TV deal, because that's a big part of the solution, to be honest. The game needs a broadcaster that's going to give it some TLC, because it needs it at the moment. Not just in terms of the actual game day coverage, but proper promotion and some discussion of the issues, some honest discussion of the issues, and honest discussion of the game in general. At the moment, the game feels as though it's existing in some never land, because you don't know when the games are. There's very little publicity. There's very little football conversation, and the reason for that is there's very few actual paid football journalists at the moment. We've all been turfed out. So this game is on the precipice at the moment. We've been there a few times in the past. I'm still confident it will not only survive but thrive, but it needs to make the right choices. Certainly the next TV deal, it needs to invest, money in particular, and also psychological investments and belief in the game. We need to get the fans back as a matter of urgency, particularly the active fans, who, provide the sort of atmosphere that I still think is unique to football in this country. We have not listened to our customers, if you want to call them that, closely enough over the last few years. And they're angry, and I don't blame them. They're not happy with what's gone on. They haven't been defended in public. They feel as though the clubs perhaps haven't listened to them as well, the governing body too. So, the game's got to do a bit of listening, and if it wants those fans back, it's got to give them what they want. Now, the answers to that are multifaceted, of course, but that will be a start. It needs investment, but not just financial, emotional, and belief in this game. And let's get back to giving the football fan what they want and stop trying to pander to the mainstream all the time. If we get our product right, if we get our game right, the mainstream will come along for the ride anyway. We've forgotten the football fans in this country, and they are paramount in their importance.
I agree so much with that. I mean, the reason I started this journey in 1997 was what I experienced in that MCG that night, which was life-changing as a sports fan. And it just upsets me as a footy person. I'm an AFL person, and I've come to this game and seen almost no trouble in 25 years. I've never seen a fist fight at the football. Yes, occasionally I've seen a flare thrown. Yes, occasionally I've seen a seat damaged. Mm. But the nature of large groups of supporters is different to the sitting side by side with your opponents that happens in AFL. And there are benefits to both.
Yeah.
And in particular, I would say that the atmosphere benefit goes with football, with round ball football. And yet there is a lack of understanding in Australia that the aroused emotions that go with that sometimes overspill, and and the overspill is all that is concentrated on in the media.
Correct.
And it has to stop. It has to be.
You know, Tony, there is you call it a misunderstanding. You're right, but I think in many places it's a willful misunderstanding of the game's culture because it doesn't suit the mainstream agenda. It doesn't suit the other codes. You know, it fits the narrative for us to be the outsider codes because, you know, football is still perceived as being a threat. I mean, you know, you go back to 2015, 16, it's only 5 years ago. We had 62,000 people for a Sydney derby, 45,000 for a Melbourne derby. You know, those sorts of figures are not to be sniffed at. And, you know, I think there was a bit of a campaign that was mounted to put football back in its box, quite frankly. And it worked because we were not strong enough. We didn't believe enough in our own game to stick two fingers up to these people and go, stuff you. Our game's great. Our fans are fantastic. Instead, we defended the articles about the troublemakers. Ludicrous.
Yeah. And I would urge anyone to start. I mean, going to games where there are 1,500 people or 2,000 people is unfortunate. But if you can get along to a game and actually take a side, like decide that you're going to be a Wanderers fan by hook or by crook and stick with them for two or three or four games and barrack. Because if you don't have emotional investment in this sport, it can look like people are tapping it around. And yes, there was a nice little act of skill, but ultimately I didn't care. Whereas it was that act of caring for me in 1997 that transformed everything.
Tony, you've hit the nail right on the head there because a lot of people in this country say, oh, the A-League's not good enough. The A-League's poor quality. It's a load of nonsense. There's poor quality games all over the world in every code of football, and there are great games as well. The difference, as you rightly pointed out, is the emotional investment in the team. And once you have that emotional investment in the team, I used to go and watch Man City when they're in the third division. The level of football was terrible. I didn't care. I still went every week. It's my team. So, you know, that's what we were building and unfortunately what we partially self-destructed because in our desperate bid to belong to the mainstream. And, well, we do belong to the mainstream and nobody cares.
Mm.
So what good has it done us?
Absolutely. It's a tragedy, but hopefully it's a recoverable tragedy and we get and the second division thing works and Australian football, you know, starts kicking goals again.
Hope so.
Simon, I thought I'd go out. We have met at World Cups. I saw you in Russia where you were a face of the Green and Gold Army as a host for one of the travelling groups of supporters in Moscow. But I also had the joy of seeing and hearing you in full flight as a rock and roll musician.
I don't know about full flight. That was very tame by my standards.
One thing I noticed is you're not a beginner. You really have played drums before, right? What's your drumming career like, Simon?
My drumming career is very amateur. Now, I've always played in bands. Started off when I was 10 or 11. Got into the British, new wave of British heavy metal genre of bands in the UK. Iron Maiden, Saxon, Motorhead, Judas Priest, all that sort of stuff. Loved it. So I wanted to be a drummer. My parents eventually relented and bought me a £40 secondhand set of drums. And I've been playing ever since. I was semi-serious about it in my teens. I was with a band called Eye to Eye. We had a bit of management interest, a bit of record label interest. But then we all went off to university. It all sort of fell apart. But I've continued to play in pub bands all my life. So I'm currently with a heavy metal cover band called Green Manalishi. Been with them for about 5 or 6 years. Absolutely love it. We gig in pubs around Sydney and we play all the old Maiden classics and Motorhead and Priest and Sabbath and all that stuff. Yeah, bring it on.
What's the best heavy metal song ever written?
Oh, the best one ever written. Blimey. I'll probably go with Maiden's 666, The Number of the Beast. Because the devil sends the beast with wrath.
Simon Hill, it is a joy to hear your voice. Do you have a favourite Iron Maiden lyric?
Woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil sends the beast with wrath, because he knows the time is short. Let him who hath understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666. 66.
The voice of Simon Hill, the voice of football in Australia, the voice of the devil. Thank you for joining us, Simon. I've really loved our chat, and best of luck getting a job in the next few weeks and months.
Thanks, Tony. Been a pleasure, mate. Always good to talk to you.
On this very football-dedicated episode of Speakola, I will mention that I wrote a football book in 2006 called Australia United. Not easy to find nowadays, but if you are after a copy, you can email me, tony@tonywilson.com.au, and I'll send you one of the last 30-odd that I've got left. You can also buy it as an ebook. I think it's in the Amazon and the Kobo stores. So if you want to fan memoir, travelling around Germany, adventures at World Cup Germany 2006, Australia United, give it a go. I mentioned this at the outset, but we do have a Patreon page as well now. You can support the show for as little as $3 a month and commit as much as you like. This year, I've received some one-off donations as well. Thank you to everyone who's helped out on that front. It's really meant a lot. And it may be that if I can get recurring donations up to a significant amount, it'll mean more episodes can happen and this podcast can be something more than a hobby. For the speech of the week, I'm thinking there might be some rusted-on Socceroos fans who have got this far in the podcast. And I don't have an extended Simon Hill speech that I can play, which would be the custom with most episodes. But I did think there is actually audio of a competing broadcast that night, the 3AW broadcast that went out on the Macquarie network. And it was hilarious. It was hosted by the 3AW station manager, Shane Healy. But really what makes the call is the special comments of Frank Farina. And Simon mentioned this in the interview, but Frank Farina had lost his job just 6 months before this World Cup qualifier. He was the previous man, the man ousted, and to watch Hoos Hiddink succeed with the team, there must have been some pain associated with that. And yet, the glory of this audio is to hear the joy and, I guess, generosity of spirit of Frank Farina. I just love it. I've listened to it a lot of times. And if Simon Hill thinks they were unprofessional over at SBS. So if you haven't heard it, November 16, 2005, Uruguay versus Australia, penalty shootout. This is wonderful.
So, Harry Kuehl, as flashes go around the stadium, Carini's on his goal line. Penalty number one. The Liverpool player, Kuehl, scores!
Yes!
Sends Carini the wrong way. Australia 1, Uruguay 0.
Oh, Frank, if that's how we feel after one, how are we going to go after five of these?
Oh, mate, I'll tell you what. I don't know if I'll still be alive. Someone give me a kick if I lie down, will you?
Okay. Well, we are 1-0 up in the penalty shootout. And the goal scorer from Montevideo, the big man Dario Rodriguez, walks to the penalty spot for Uruguay. And he will attempt to make it 1-1. For those who don't know the game of soccer well, both sides take five compulsory kicks. If it's dead level after that five, then we go 1-1, 1-1 until there's a winner. Schwarzer in goal. Rodriguez will kick on the left. He comes up, he stutters.
Yes!
It's been saved. Australia is in front in the penalty shootout. Australia is in front.
Come on!
It is 1-0. Stay calm, boys. Stay calm.
I told you, Schwarzer.
Schwarzer has made a brilliant save. It was unbelievable. Rodriguez played a few games, Frank, as he ran in and then he stuttered and he walked. Schwarzer's save was marvellous.
Yeah, well, Schwarzer kept us in the game in Montevideo with two fantastic saves, and he's done it again tonight.
Lucas Neal
steps up, who was brilliant as a sweeper here tonight. A clean sheet for the Australians. Lucas Neal, only have two steps at the ball. And
yes!
Again, sending the keeper the wrong way. Australia 2, Uruguay 0, with Uruguay having a shot to come.
Now, if you've just turned on your radio around Australia and you're wondering where Stan Zamanek is, or where Bruce and Phil are, or where Graham Mabry is, they'll be on a little bit later, folks. But this is world-class sport in our own country, in this magnificent city of Sydney. And now, Australia with a 2-0 lead. And it's number 7.
Yes, number 7, which is Barella.
He plays for Schalke in Germany. He's had a great game. If he misses, Australia's 2-0 up. Here's the kick. It's in.
Oh, it's gone under Schwarzer. It's
Schwarzer
gone under.
Went the right way, but Barella's put it in. Australia leads 2-1. And just repeating, both sides will have 5 compulsory kicks. So at the moment, 2 of those are down for both teams. It is 2-1 to Australia.
Frank, Tony Vidmar steps up, I think, now.
Yes, that's Tony Vidmar.
And?
Look, Tony's got experience. I hope for him he'll put it in. Look, I've got confidence in him.
Oh, good on you, Frank. Let's hope he's got confidence in himself. This is the most suspenseful passage of sport you'd ever likely to witness. Tony Vidmar, the 35-year-old, in his 75th match for Australia, comes in and scores! Yes! Again, Carini's beaten the wrong way. Australia 3, Uruguay 1. Uruguay have a kick to come.
It's not over yet, but Australia hold a significant advantage. Uruguay to take their third kick, but they've missed their first penalty. Frank, Australia lead 3-1. We're not home yet, boys.
Oh, not yet, but we're close. Vidmar actually took it with his left foot, so I think he was extremely confident there.
Well, this is the young fellow, Fabian Stoyanov. He wears number 13 for Uruguay, the famous sky blue. He'll kick on the right foot. He kicks. He scores brilliantly. He sent Schwarzer the wrong way, and he scores in the right-hand corner. But Australia does have that vital one-goal lead. It is 3-2, and Frank, who's jogging down?
Viduka. It's a big V-bomber. He's coming in for the fourth.
Mark Viduka. The Scottish Player of the Year in 2000, he was at Celtic. A fine product from Australia. He's the captain. Let's see, in this most important match in his career, if he can beat Carini in goals. Viduka steps up, and Viduka misses!
Oh dear.
Viduka misses!
You don't believe the pressure that is on these players. You know, you can be in a situation like that where you've taken penalties all throughout your career, and you come into a stadium that's filled with 83,000 Australians who are desperate for you to finish. It gets to everyone. It's unfortunate. I don't know whether he saved at the keeper or it's gone wide. But we're still alive. We're still there.
Okay, well, it is now 2-2. And both sides
it's dead even.
Had 3 attempts.
That's it. We're back to square one.
Uruguay's Marcelo Zalayeta steps up. It's dead level. With 2 compulsory kicks to come. Zalayeta.
Yes! Schwarzer!
It's been saved by Schwarzer. It's a brilliant save by Schwarzer.
He's got it.
He reached across to his left and he got the left hand to it. It was a magnificent save.
If Johnny Aloisi scores, we're at the World Cup.
That's it!
This kick for John Aloisi to put Australia into the World Cup. Aloisi, now.
Frank, you know him. Take our listeners through. What's John Aloisi?
He scored in the Confederations Cup against Argentina. I don't know. This is the kick to get us to the World Cup.
I don't care if a broadcast another minute on radio. Here we go, Aloisi.
Yes!
Australia is there!
Right there!
Australia
is there!
Australia is there! World Cup. Oh. This game has arrived. Soccer has arrived in Australia.
Look, the place has gone mad. These yellow streamers are streaming to the roof. I'm being embraced here by people everywhere. This is unbelievable. Frank Farina, try and get your headphones on, mate. Oh, being kissed. I can't believe it. Frank, unbelievable. Talk
this is incredible. We're going to Germany. Mark Schwarzer again as the 93. He's put Australia into the World Cup for the first time in 32 years. Unbelievable.
Well, here it is. Australia has beaten Uruguay in a penalty shootout. The Australia
seen here is absolutely beyond belief. Greg Marina's been bear-hugged by people here. Uruguay is trudging off. Australia, there's people spilling onto the pitch here with Australian flags. Australia is through to the World Cup. And it's great to be standing here next to a man who had a big part to play in Australia getting there. Frank Farina, tell us how you're feeling, sir. I think we've lost Frank just for the minute. Let's turn that button on for me, Frankie.
Where you we going? Got it. I can hardly talk. My voice is almost gone. Incredible. It's deja vu. Mark Schwarzer will be a national hero, as will everyone else there. Listen, it's unbelievable working with these guys for 6 years. The heartache, the problems we've gone through. And tonight, finally, we're there. We're at the World Cup. Oh, look, I don't know what I'm feeling. I think tonight I'm going to have a bloody stiff drink and most probably get down and have a great time with the lads.
Frank, it's absolutely been marvellous having you here as part of this. You showed a lot of character just being here. It was disappointing you couldn't be out there coaching. Tonight you've steered all of Australia with you through this unbelievable 120 minutes.
That's it for the episode. I hope you found parts of it as joyous and uplifting as I did. Big thank you to you, Simon Hill. We need you to stay in Australia. Fox Sports, or whoever gets the rights. Simon Hill must stay. I don't want to have to take to the streets with signs, but I am prepared to do that. Thank you to our donors and Patreon subscribers. Thank you to Dave Bridie for the music. Always appreciated. Love the theme. Thank you to Greenskin and Purple Skin Avocados, the website, greenskinavocados.com.au. A big thank you to the Socceroos and all the joy they've brought me. I've been to 4 World Cups following the team, and it really has been such a great part of my life. If you, like me, are a bit of a football fan, I'm making a football documentary, and it's called Ferenc Puskas and the South Melbourne Hellas. It's about the great Ferenc Puskas, the Hungarian legend of the 1950s, coming to South Melbourne Hellas in the late 80s as a coach, coaching them to the 1991 NSL Championship. Quite a remarkable story of a Hungarian in exile meeting the Greek community here in Melbourne, and just love making it. Anyway, we have a fundraising page up for that film, crowdfunding the 100,000 we need to get to the line. And if you go to the Documentary Australia website, which is in the notes of this episode, you could contribute and help us pay the $286 per second that FIFA need for footage clearances. Good on you, FIFA. What a benevolent organisation you are. That's the end of the episode. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next time.